TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. John Mersheimer discusses Gaza. Interview on TRT, the Turkish Public Broadcast Service. On May 18, 2024, Paul Salvatori, presenter and senior producer at TRT World, invited Professor John Mersheimer for a conversation. Professor Mersheimer is an American political scientist and international relations scholar who belongs to the realist school of thought. He's based at the University of Chicago and best known for describing the interaction between great powers as being primarily driven by the desire to achieve regional hegemony. Mersheimer is also internationally known for the 2007 book he co-authored with Stephen Walt, entitled The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. The core argument is that the Israel lobby wields disproportionate influence over U.S. policy, both domestic and international. Paul Salvatori begins the conversation by asking Mersheimer whether his theory of offensive realism applies to the Israeli attack of Gaza. Here is Professor John Mersheimer.
I'm not sure that Israel's assault on Gaza has much to do with realism, but I'll give you first my take on what realism is, and then I can talk about the Israeli assault on Gaza. Realism is a theory of international politics that privileges power. It says power is the currency of international relations, and states are mainly concerned, not exclusively, but mainly concerned about the balance of power, and they want to maximize the amount of power they have. The best situation is to be a hegemon in the system. Now, why is that the case? The argument that I make is that if a state operates in a world where there's no higher authority that can rescue it if it gets in trouble, and one can never know what the intentions of another state are today, and certainly cannot know what their intentions will be in the future, and that rival state may be very powerful. In that world, you want to make sure you are much more powerful than all of your rivals. Because again, if it turns out that the intentions of another state are malign, and that state is really powerful, and you get into trouble, there's no higher authority you can turn to. So in a world like that, it makes eminently good sense to be as powerful as possible, indeed, to be the hegemon in the system. But of course, all states understand that basic logic, and the end result is that you get a competition for power. I call that security competition. And sometimes that security competition results in war. So that's the basic argument that I lay out. And as you can tell from listening to me talk, it's really a structural argument. It's the structure of the international system. It's the fact that there is no higher authority, states cannot know each other's intentions, and some states are much more powerful than others, that drives states to compete for power. So that's the basic realist theory. Now, the reason it doesn't apply to the Israeli-Palestinian case is we're not talking about rival states. We're talking about one state, which is Greater Israel, and we're talking about the fact that inside of Greater Israel, the Palestinians in Gaza are revolting against the Israelis. This is basically a prison break. What happened was that the Israelis, in effect, locked the Palestinians in Gaza up in a giant open air prison, and they treated them horribly. And what happened on October 7th is you had a prison break, and the Israelis reacted to that by invading Gaza. But this is not a competition between two states. If we had long ago gotten a two-state solution and there was a Palestinian state side by side with an Israeli state, then realist logic would apply because you'd have two states competing with each other. But the Israelis had no interest in creating a Palestinian state, so you have a greater Israel. And what you have here is basically a rebellion by these prisoners who are locked up in Gaza.
And you've also talked about rationality, states acting rationally or irrationally. And I'm wondering if we were to apply it to the case of Israel, whether it'd be safe to say that they're acting irrationally, because something you observed recently, correct me if I'm wrong, is that Israel is trying to defeat Hamas, but it will never be able to do so. So how in that sense is that in Israel's interest to keep waging this war?
Well, it is in Israel's interest to defeat Hamas. Whether you think it's morally correct or politically correct is another matter. I mean, I believe that the Israelis should have long ago given the Palestinians a state of their own. That was the smart thing to do. But they've decided not to do that. Now, there's no question that the Israelis went into Gaza and they argued that what they wanted to do was defeat Hamas. And given that it is virtually impossible to defeat Hamas in combat, in other words, for the Israeli Defense Force is to engage Hamas and eliminate them, it's virtually impossible. One could argue that's irrational, but I don't believe that was Israel's goal. I mean, they said that was their goal. Their ultimate goal, I believe, from the beginning was to ethnically cleanse Gaza, to drive the Palestinians out of Gaza. And by the way, if they had done that, then they would have eliminated Hamas as a problem in Gaza. Do you follow what I'm saying here? So one could argue that the decision to try to drive Hamas out of Gaza and the Palestinians in toto out of Gaza was morally wrong, but one could say it was a rational strategy from Israel's point of view. Now you're saying to yourself, why would I say that? The fact is that Israel, greater Israel, is today an apartheid state. And for purposes of the future, it's not clear that Israel can maintain itself over the long term as an apartheid state, because an apartheid state is such a repugnant notion to huge numbers of people in the West. And the Israelis worry that someday they will go the way of South Africa, which of course was an apartheid state and is no more, at least as an apartheid state. So what the Israelis would like to do is they'd like to ethnically cleanse Gaza and ethnically cleanse the West Bank so that you have a greater Israel that's filled mainly with Israeli Jews, and almost all of the Palestinians are gone. That's their ideal. And I think they saw what happened on October 7th as an opportunity to cleanse, to ethnically cleanse Gaza. And that's what they set out to do. And I think that was a rational strategy, even though I want to make it clear, I think it was an abhorrent strategy from a moral point of view. But it failed. And the end result is they not only did not drive the Palestinians out of Gaza, thankfully, in my opinion, but they also have not defeated Hamas.
Do you think that Israel's seeming lack of concern of the international community trying to stop what they're doing and the likelihood that they'll become a pariah state if they don't is irrational? And how seriously they take that, because if they do get, you know, this way, hypothetically, where they take Gaza and they do what they want with it, would it not just further alienate them from everyone else? And what kind of winning
position?
Well,
the problem in your argument is the use of the word everyone else.
Right.
For the Israelis, what really matters is what the United States does. But not only the United States, countries like Canada and countries in Europe. Yes. And the fact is the Israelis can do almost anything to the Palestinians and the Americans, the Canadians and the Europeans, especially the West Europeans, will stand by them. Mm-hmm. We see this even with the Germans today, who you would think, given their experience with genocide, would be opposing what the Israelis are doing in Gaza. But the Germans are standing by the Israelis, as are the Americans and pretty much everybody else in the West. So the Israelis think they have a free hand here. But of course, in almost all other places on the planet, they are in deep trouble because people in those other places understand that the Israelis are executing a genocide, and they think that this is unacceptable.
Right. So perhaps what I was trying to get at is that could a state like Israel survive this way long term? If it just has the help of, say, a handful of powerful states long term, is this in any state's interest?
Well, I think there are good reasons to think that an apartheid state cannot last over the long term. And as I said before, I think the Israelis themselves understand that. And we now have a situation where you're not only dealing with an apartheid state, Israel, but you're dealing with an apartheid state that is in the process of executing a genocide in Gaza. And that is going to be a moral stain on Israel's reputation. I'm tempted to say for the foreseeable future, but one could say forever. This is a disastrous situation for Israel. The Israelis tend to think they can get away with it now because Western elites are backing them pretty much to the hilt. But with the passage of time, when people take stock of what happened after October 7th and what the Israelis are now doing, it will, I believe, be disastrous for Israel's reputation. So you marry the genocidal behavior with the fact that it's an apartheid state, and Israel's future does not look promising.
And to your point about Israel getting help from Americans, I presume that would also include the Israeli lobby or some segments of the Israeli lobby, and you're known for your seminal book on the Israeli lobby. I'm just wondering how you've seen the Israeli lobby develop with respect to American policy since you wrote that book, and how it's facilitating the ongoing assault or genocide on Gaza right now.
Well, there's no question that the Israel lobby is playing a key role in keeping the West on Israel's side. No doubt about that. We wrote the article, Steve Walt and I, about the Israel lobby in 2006, and then we wrote the book in 2007. So that was quite a while ago, a good 18 years for the article. I think there's no question that we have had a profound effect as a result of the article and the book on the discourse about Israel. I think we opened up a big discussion or a widespread discussion on the Israel lobby, the U.S.-Israeli relationship, and on Israeli policy itself. But I think we have had zero effect on actual policy, right? So again, we've influenced the discourse for sure, but in terms of actual policy, zero influence. And I think that tells you two things. One is the lobby is incredibly powerful. And number two, I would argue that the lobby has become more powerful with the passage of time. I think what's happened here is that it has become increasingly difficult to defend Israel in public discourse in the West. I think Israeli behavior is so outrageous on occasion that the lobby has to work overtime to defend Israel. And I think it's fair to say that the lobby has risen to the occasion. It's, you know, gotten stronger with the passage of time, and it does an amazing job of protecting Israel. I want to be clear here. I do not think this is in the American national interest, and I don't think it's in Israel's interest as well. I think that the lobby, in effect, has helped lead Israel down the primrose path. So I want to be very clear on that. I don't think the lobby is good for either the United States or for Israel. But nevertheless, it is very powerful. But there's one other aspect of the lobby that we should talk about that's important to understand. Lobbies, or interest groups, and there are many of them in the United States, are most effectively when they can work behind closed doors and they can work in very subtle ways. And people are not talking about the influence of this lobby or that lobby, whether it's the National Rifle Association, the Cuba lobby, or the Israel lobby. But what's happened over time, and I think that we've played a key role here, in bringing the lobby's actions out into the open is that the lobby now has to engage in smash mouth politics. It has to operate out in the open in brazen ways. And therefore, more and more people have become aware of the Israel lobby's presence in the American body politic, and they've become more aware of how the lobby works. And this is not good for the lobby, and it's not good for Israel. And this is another reason why, when you think about sort of where Israel will be and where the lobby will be moving forward, it's hard to tell a positive story. It looks like there's big trouble ahead for Israel and big trouble ahead for the lobby.
Right. Well, I'm glad you brought that up, actually, because when I was reading the article in the book, it seemed that at some point that the lobby was successful in working this way that you're talking about behind closed doors, versus now it just seems like everyone knows that it's there and it's influencing politicians and policy. Do you see this as being a vulnerability for it now, and it's in a position where it can actually be weakened on account of it?
Well, it's a vulnerability because it makes it difficult to tell the story that the United States supports Israel because it's in America's strategic interest, mm-hmm. and because it is the morally correct thing to do.
Yes.
What the lobby like to do, and likes to do, yes. is make the argument that Americans support Israel down the line because it's in our interest. We're birds of a feather, right? We're supporting our ally. Israel's the only democracy in the Middle East. It shares our values. This is the argument that it's morally and strategically correct to support Israel. And what we said in the article and in the book is that that's not true. Strategically, Israel's basically an albatross around America's neck. And the argument that it's ethically correct to support Israel against the Palestinians has been wrong for a long, long time, well before October 7th. And the real reason that we support Israel is because of the lobby, not because of strategic or moral logic. And once the lobby is out in the open and you see the lobby wielding its influence in sort of very heavy-handed ways, that works to undermine the argument that Israel and the United States are close together for strategic and moral reasons, because you wouldn't need a lobby
right.
if there were strategic and moral reasons for a close relationship. The reason you need a lobby is because Israel is not a strategic asset. It's a strategic liability, and its behavior towards the Palestinians is morally reprehensible. And I want to be clear, it has been for a long period of time. This is not something that started on October 7th. So to deal with this situation, you need a lobby. But it's, again, best if that lobby is in the background, and it is not any longer in the background. I want to make one other point on this, Paul. Very important to understand that the coming of social media has changed the game in very important ways. It was much easier to work in the background, and it was much easier to sort of cover up what Israel was doing before the coming of social media. With social media now, there's just all sorts of videos on the internet of what the Israelis are doing in Gaza. There are all sorts of alternative platforms for critics of Israel to speak on regarding the war in Gaza. Yes, the mainstream media continues to support Israel down the line, but the fact is that there are alternative platforms where people can go and criticize Israel. And lots of young people have turned off the mainstream media, and what they do is they go to these alternative sources. This is one of the principal reasons that the lobby is committed to shutting down TikTok. Yes. TikTok runs all sorts of videos that portray the Israelis acting towards the Palestinians in barbaric ways. Yes. And when young people see these videos on TikTok, they obviously become remarkably sympathetic to the Palestinians, and they think badly, to put it mildly, of the Israelis. So the lobby would like to shut down TikTok. The problem is that in the age of social media, there are just real limits to what you can do. And this is going to cause these real huge problems moving forward. This is not the old world that I grew up in, where the mainstream media was all you had.
Right. I'm wondering philosophically if you have any insight into how does the lobby actually succeed in America? Because conceivably, for example, you can think of a world where politicians, legislators are approached by the lobby and they say no, right? What you're asking is immoral. Human lives are at stake. But we're seeing the opposite. And I'm wondering if part of the lobby's success is that somehow it's able to incentivize immoral behavior and how it does that.
Well, let me talk a little bit about how the lobby operates. It operates at two levels, one of which you were talking about and one which you were not talking about. The first level, which you were not talking about, is in terms of public opinion and in terms of dealing with the public. And there, the lobby is deeply concerned with controlling as much as possible the discourse. It's what we were talking about before. The lobby does not want Israel to be portrayed in a negative light. The lobby does not want much discussion of the lobby's role in American politics, right? The lobby wants to control the discourse or influence the discourse as much as possible. That has become exceedingly difficult to do. Second, and this is the second avenue of influence, the lobby is interested in making sure that policymakers inside Congress and inside the executive branch, and here we're talking not just about the White House, but also the State Department, the Defense Department, and so forth and so on, making sure those policymakers support Israel unconditionally. That word unconditionally cannot be underestimated. So the name of the game here is to influence those policymakers. Now, there are obviously many policymakers who think that what Israel is doing in Gaza is reprehensible, but they will not speak out. And they will vote in support of Israel at almost every turn. There will be a few exceptions, but not many. That raises the question, why? And the answer is that in the United States, to get elected to office and to remain in office, campaign contributions matter enormously. And the lobby is really good at providing money, providing resources for individuals who support the lobby's positions. And anyone who doesn't support the lobby's positions will find him or herself being opposed by someone in the next primary or in the next campaign by someone who supports Israel and who is getting a huge amount of money from pro-Israel sources. So politicians, and this again includes politicians in the executive branch and in the legislative branch, understand that there will be a huge price to pay if they don't support Israel hook, line, and sinker. And they end up, in almost all cases, supporting Israel as a result. If you took away the ability of the lobby to provide campaign funds for political candidates, I think you would see very different voting patterns. Because this is not a case of all these politicians loving Israel and feeling they have to support Israel because it shares our values or it's a strategic asset. They do it in good part out of fear that the lobby will put its crosshairs on them and defeat them for office.
Mm-hmm. I think this is why realism and how you explain is so fascinating, because you use the word reprehensible. And I wonder why there seems to be so many politicians who are willing to cross that line or be complicit in this reprehensibility.
Well, the fact is that every human being has a moral compass, and at the same time, they have a set of interests. Sometimes that set of interests and the moral compass are lined up, and you can pursue a policy or take action that is morally correct and also maximizes your chances of satisfying your political or economic goals. But then there are those cases where your moral compass points in one direction and your interest compass points in the other direction. And then the question is, what do you do? And there are going to be cases where people do what their moral compass says they should do. But as we both know from studying history, there are lots of cases where people put aside what is morally correct, according to their own compass, and instead pursue policies that are morally incorrect, but satisfy their own political or economic interests. This happens a lot, sadly. And I think that this is a case of that. You have a lot of people who know better. They nevertheless think that from a political point of view, from the point of view of their own selfish interests, that what they should do is support Israel's behavior in Gaza or support Israel's treatment of the Palestinians even before October 7th. You want to understand that the Israelis ethnically cleansed the Palestinians in 1948. Yes. They ethnically cleansed lots of Palestinians in 1948. And then they did it again in 1967 in the West Bank when they captured the West Bank from Jordan. So they've done massive ethnic cleansing on two occasions and they got away with it. And it played a key role in creating the State of Israel. So there are a number of people, I've talked to a few of them over the years in Israel, who believe that when the opportunity comes, they will be able to ethnically cleanse Gaza and the West Bank, greatly reduce the number of Palestinians in both of those places, and therefore greatly reduce the number of Palestinians in Greater Israel, and the end result is they will be much better off. They will have gotten away with it. Yes, there will be a certain moral stain that is associated with this, but they'll deal with that. So that's the rational argument for doing this. And who knows? They may get away with it. You want to remember, we're talking about a world here where the United States and the Europeans, especially the Germans, will basically support Israel no matter what it does. So one could argue it's not such a foolish policy. Is it a morally bankrupt policy? Yes. May it ultimately turn out to be a reckless policy? Yes. But that remains to be seen.
That was the American political scientist and international relations scholar John Mersheimer. He's the R. Wendell Harrison Distinguished Service Professor at the University of Chicago. Mersheimer has recently been in high demand for his comments and interviews on China, Ukraine, and Gaza. Mersheimer was invited by Paul Salvatori, presenter and senior producer at TRT, the Turkish Public Broadcast Service. They spoke on May 18, 2024. You can watch the full 30-minute conversation on YouTube under the title John Mersheimer Discusses Gaza. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening.